This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Last night, Governor Eric Holcomb addressed the state and gave an update on where things stand when it comes to the fight against COVID-19. With us today to talk more about the governor's remarks, we're joined by two local reporters, Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette and Brandon Smith, State House reporter with Indiana Public Broadcasting. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much.
Glad to be here.
Well, we'll start with Governor Holcomb. He mentioned last night that the current state public health emergency and COVID executive order expire at the end of the month and that he plans to renew the public health emergency for another 30 days. Let's take a listen.
Because it allows us to take action quickly if conditions take a turn for the worse, and allows us to continue to access the hundreds of millions of dollars in federal funds that are helping the hardest hit Hoosiers weather this lingering storm.
Brandon, was it expected that the governor would extend this emergency order?
The emergency declaration, yes, for the reasons he just talked about. Less the flexibility argument and more the we would lose out on a lot of federal help argument. And if you talk to lawmakers who have been very opposed to a lot of the things that Governor Holcomb has done throughout the pandemic in terms of the executive orders that he's used. Now, the way that the law works is by declaring a public emergency, which is what he's going to keep going for another 30 days, that triggers in law all of the executive powers that the governor has used throughout the pandemic to do everything from the mask wearing mandates and the stay at home orders to just last week extending the deadline to pay your taxes by about a month because that's what the federal government did. All of those are executive powers that he's used through that through the emergency declaration. So extending that another month, no, not that much of a surprise. I could even see it being extended more. And that's not what lawmakers had trouble with. Lawmakers, a lot of Republican lawmakers particularly, really hated the mask mandate. Really hated the stay-at-home order, you know, last year, but the mask mandate that was still ongoing. And so getting rid of those while also maintaining the emergency declaration made the most sense.
Mm-hmm. And we'll definitely talk a little bit more about that mask mandate being lifted a little later. Nikki, was there anything significant about his remarks last night that stood out to you?
Well, obviously, I mean, the two major ones is he's opening up vaccination for everyone 16 and older March 31st. So everyone who is above 40 or above, you know, you should get your appointment now because about 2 million people are going to become eligible on that day. And obviously dropping the mask mandate and the local or the statewide restrictions on like business capacities, social distancing, the 6 feet limits. Those are big. He's now put the onus on local health officials, which is, you know, I feel a little bad for them there. But so we might see a lot more sort of patchwork restrictions under that.
Mm-hmm. When you say that now it's going to be on local health officials to figure things out, I mean, what's their preparation going to look like if they're supposed to hold the power now?
Well, technically, the state is still providing them all the data that we have now. You know, every Wednesday we get the color-coded map that's updated with the advisory levels and the recommendations. So they can follow all that guidance to issue their own rules, like Marion County has done this whole time. But a lot of counties haven't done that. They have relied on the statewide restrictions. So it's just going to be more up to them whether they want to follow the guidance and actually mm-hmm. put new rules on their citizens instead of relying on the state order.
Right. Brandon, do you see this having any effect now on sort of the smaller local governments trying to navigate this? Is it going to be harder for them?
Absolutely it is. As Nikki just pointed out, a lot of counties were kind of relying on the state to take the heat, essentially, because these are unpopular. Like, there's no doubt that the mask wearing order and the social distancing and the gathering restrictions, they're unpopular. You could argue they're necessary. They've been necessary to help try to maintain the spread of this incredibly infectious virus, but and deadly in a lot of cases. But yeah, it's going to be harder. I suspect, and this is just my personal opinion covering this, you know, this pandemic throughout the last 12, 13 months, is that I just think you're not going to see a lot of restrictions. I think, you know, Nikki mentioned Marion County, Indianapolis has had restrictions in place throughout the pandemic that in some that oftentimes have been more strict than what the state has done, which the state has allowed this entire time. There have been a couple other examples of that. But I mean, a couple of my colleagues and I were talking about this morning, and I think I can count on one hand the number of counties that will have, if I were to guess, a mask mandate after the states goes away.
And Nikki, is the governor taking examples from any of the other states, like Texas, for example, with this mask mandate removal?
You know, I honestly don't think he's looking at what other states are doing. I think he's feeling the pressure from within the state, and that's coming from lawmakers who have the ability right now to cancel that entire declaration. And he's trying to find a middle ground that keeps the declaration in place in case things get worse or to get some of the federal money that's coming our way, but take away the sort of unpopular parts that the Republican lawmakers are pushing back on. So he's trying to find a middle ground, or otherwise the lawmakers are just going to end it altogether.
Right. And we've been talking about this mask mandate. For those who weren't listening to the remarks last night, Governor Holcomb spoke about how the state mask mandate being lifted on April 6th is going to be turned into a state mask advisory. Let's take a listen.
Although face coverings will remain mandatory in all state buildings and facilities, and in all vaccination and COVID testing sites until further notice.
So, Brandon, it sounds like there's still going to be some form of mask wearing. It's not like this free-for-all, just lift it off and do what you please. Brandon,
well,
if you can
unmute. I'll just jump in real quick because he's muted, but obviously it's an advisory. And some people would argue that our mask mandate was never a mandate in the first place because we had zero actual enforcement of it. So, and I do want to note that he made very clear to say that the mask wearing would still be required in K-12 schools till the end of the school year. So there are some small caveats.
Mm-hmm. Well, does this give mixed messages, Brandon? Does this give mixed messages for folks who are just like, okay, now we don't have to wear masks, but then you have to wear it to school? I mean, could this cause some drama along the way?
Yes. First, thanks, Nikki, for stepping in while I forgot to unmute myself. And she said exactly what I was going to say, so it's perfect anyway. But yeah, that's exactly, I think, the problem you have here. Mixed messages within the speech itself. On the one hand, the governor is saying, no more mask mandate. On the other hand, but I'm going to continue wearing a mask because it's the right thing to do. On the other hand, it's going to be required in state government buildings. But quite frankly, as Nikki pointed out, on the other hand, it's never been really been enforced very well in state government buildings. So who are we to believe? Now, there are Hoosiers that were never going to wear a mask. They can't do anything about that. And there are Hoosiers who are going to be wearing a mask long after, most likely, a lot of the rest of us stop. But there is a group in the middle who were taking guidance from the state, who looked to the governor and to the state health commissioner, who said, there is a mask mandate in place, and said, okay, I'm going to do this thing. Even if the police aren't wandering around forcing anybody to do it, it's the right thing to do. I'm going to do it. And now they're hearing the state say, well, you don't have to do it anymore. Even as the governor is saying, but you should still do it, I think.
Mm-hmm.
That's absolutely a mixed message. And I think some people out there are going to be a little confused about what exactly they should be doing.
Right. And how many people do you think are actually going to pay attention to the date of April 6th and are just going to start now?
Yeah, that's another good question. I mean, yes, there will be some for whom this is a green light to go ahead and ditch the mask that's been annoying them for so long. There will be others who are going to wear masks long after April 6th and beyond. So I think it's going to be a struggle for some people. The thing that gets me about this is the mask mandate was always going to go away. But at the same time, we have more and more vaccines coming. But, you know, Nikki pointed out that there's going to be a huge increase in the number of people who are eligible for a vaccine starting next week. Now, that's coinciding with we are going to start getting a lot more vaccine, according to the federal government. And you can actually look on the HHS, on the Health and Human Services Agency's website at the federal government to see how much of the vaccine Indiana is going to get. And next week, we are going to get about a 40% increase over what we've been getting in the vaccine. That's huge. But he's opened up eligibility, by 440%. There is quite simply not enough vaccine to go around yet. And it's going to be a while before everyone who wants one can get one. And yet, well before that happens, there are no restrictions at the statewide level.
Right. Well, as we get ready to wrap up here, Nikki, the governor highlighted things like low unemployment rates, as Brandon mentioned, increase in vaccines being rolled out. Was there anything glaring that was left out of his remarks? It just all sounded very positive. But what was missing?
Yeah, I didn't see anything massively missing. And obviously, he's going to focus on the positive. I would say the most criticism that you could see is that we spent, 17 minutes talking about the past year and only the last few minutes talking about the future. And I think people know what happened the past year. It's been rough and they kind of want to move on.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Brandon, any last thoughts you think people should take away from the remarks last night?
It's hard not to look at it as the governor saying, well, we're about done, everybody. While in reality, I think a lot of people aren't done with the pandemic and won't be for a while. So it'll be interesting to see what the path forward is for the governor specifically in terms of how he handles things from here on out. I mean, if he's gotten rid of all the restrictions and he's opened up the vaccine eligibility to everyone, what will his continuing messaging be like? I think that'll be something to watch out for as we see the next few weeks and even months play out.
All right. Well, thank you so much. We were just joined by Nikki Kelly and Brandon Smith breaking down the governor's address last night on the fight against COVID-19 and where Indiana stands. We'll keep an eye on the data and the messaging as we move forward. When we come back, we'll be talking about juvenile justice and the powerful stories within courtrooms. If you have any questions or comments for the show, you want to get in on the discussion, let us know. Go to Facebook or Twitter and find us at All in Indiana. Leave us a message there. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. Back after a quick break. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. What goes on when it comes to juvenile justice and how can the system be reformed? Indiana is one of the first states to shed light on this topic. And just how did that come about? We'll find out from our guests today. With us, we have Karen Graw, juvenile justice documentarian, media producer, and former Indiana juvenile justice reporter. Mary Beth Bonaventura, a senior judge in Lake County and former Indiana Superior Court juvenile justice. And Don Rock, an Indiana juvenile justice attorney. Welcome to all of you. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for having us, Miriam.
Mary Beth, the state Senate recently introduced a bill on more juvenile justice reform, proposals like expunging some juvenile records, among other things. What kind of effect would a bill like this have on the courts if passed?
You could look at it that if there are certain cases in which juveniles will have their records automatically expunged, it'll be maybe less work. But I think that the juvenile court has always been about what's right for kids and what to do in the best interests of children. So I would be surprised how many judges would be in favor of there being a law that would say if a youth is charged with certain offenses or is found guilty of certain offenses, that automatically they would get expungements after a certain period of time. I don't think I would not be in favor of that. Because I think we've all been around long enough to know that these aren't cookie cutter instances. There are, differences in facts and situations in everybody's life and in everybody's case. So there might be that case that really wouldn't rise to the level of it being in anybody's best interest and public safety to have an automatic expungement. So I think that it might be less work if there are automatic expungements as opposed to having to have cases and hear evidence on each and every case.
Mm-hmm. And on that note, there's also another side. There's also another bill, I believe, that's in play right now that would have offenders, second-time offenders with weapons, I believe, if they're 16 or 17 years old, be tried in adult court. Is that common for these things to occur for teenagers to be tried as adults?
Well, back in the day when I first started in the juvenile justice field, we won't talk about years because I don't like to think how old I am. But there were five instances where juveniles could be charged and tried as adults. And now I think there's like, Don could answer better than me. I've been out of it sort of for the last several years, but there's like 13 or 15 cases or charges that a youth could have that would have them be charged and tried as adults. And so, I mean, I personally feel that we have a juvenile court system for a reason. And that reason is because when we are of a certain age, our brains haven't developed to where they should be and could be when we make right decisions and thought out decisions. So I think the juvenile court is there for kids to make mistakes and make choices that they wouldn't otherwise make if their brains were developed. And so then to say that there's a certain age group or a certain kind of crime that if committed would automatically have them be charged and tried as adults, I'm not in favor of that. I think that every case should turn on its own merits and its own facts and situations. I'm probably a minority.
But speaking of what you just said, Don, I mean, what are your thoughts on how juveniles are tried in courts and these sort of ages and when, I guess there's like a blurred line of whether they're considered adults or not.
Yeah, and you're right. I mean, I think what we need to do is start from the understanding that, at least as I view it, the primary overarching goal of the juvenile court system in dealing with kids who commit what would be a crime if they were adult is not necessarily punishment, but to try and rehabilitate them so that hopefully that type of behavior and the cause of it is identified and then so it doesn't happen again. So when we approach these cases, we're always looking at it from the standpoint is how can we help put this child back on the right path, as opposed to how can we lock them up, and punish them for an extended period of time. And I think the cases become more difficult the more serious the crime is that's involved. And obviously, the closer that child is to the age of 18, I think that's what we're struggling with these bills, is trying to balance as the crime gets more serious and the age gets greater. At what point do we say now the goal becomes punishment and locking somebody up so they can't hurt somebody else, as opposed to rehabilitating that person so they can go back home and hopefully, get their life back on track.
Mm-hmm. And how much, I'm just curious, how much does research into brain development factor into any of these decisions that are made? You know, just every year you find new information and new studies. Have you had to deal with that at all, Don?
I would say from my perspective and in the cases that I handle, it's not been enough yet in terms of the actual how it plays out in the courtroom setting. Luckily, at least in Lake County, it's a very large juvenile court system here with a lot of different cases handling a lot of different situations. And the judges and the magistrates that hear the cases, I think, are pretty good at trying to approach it from the standpoint that Mary Beth was just talking about, of really trying to look at it from the child's perspective and do what's right. And we haven't had to have a lot of cases where we're fighting over necessarily the biological inner workings of what's happening with the kids. But I do see that, like you said, that evidence and that type of research is really starting to come out now and to demonstrate that, you know, kids of a certain age don't think the way adults do. And I think as the years go on, we're going to find more of that evidence becoming important in these cases.
Mm-hmm. Now, Karen, you've been documenting juvenile justice for more than 20 years. And what made you decide to focus on this subject?
Well, it wasn't intentional, I can tell you that much. I started my career in sports broadcasting, which you can't get much further apart than that. It was actually when I sat inside my first juvenile court, and I will tell you that Judge Bonaventura's court was one of the first courts that I observed. I was asked by my husband to assist him on a research project he was working on. I didn't want to go, I'll be honest. I thought to myself, I have no interest in these courts and these cases. I knew nothing about them. But after sitting in court for 5 minutes, the journalist in me just said, how is it the public doesn't know the magnitude of the stories inside these courts? And after, you know, watching my first juvenile delinquency hearing and my first child abuse and neglect hearing, I just knew that at some point I had to try and petition to get cameras inside these courts so people could understand these very issues that we're discussing here a little more deeply. I think it's very easy to read, excuse me, it's very easy to read a headline and assume what these kids are like, what these families are like. But when you go inside these courts and you meet the people and you meet the judges and you meet the defense attorneys like Don, you realize there are these vast gray areas with these cases. It's not as simple as, oh, here's the bad guy, here's the good guy. At the heart of it all is a child. And whether or not you're talking about, you know, a five-year-old who's a victim of physical abuse or sexual abuse, or whether you're talking about a 16-year-old who has come in on an egregious charge, at the end of the day, these are still children. And that really captivated me. And I've told Judge Bonaventura this many times during the course of our filming together. You know, court would end and I would say, I have no idea how you made that decision. Like, how did you come to that decision in 20 minutes? I sat there and labored over what the right answer was. And I think that Mary Beth and Don would both probably agree that there are certain tools in their toolbox, if you will, inside juvenile court that helps them make these really difficult decisions regarding kids and families. And all of that combined is what attracted me to this subject matter.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, we're talking about juvenile justice reform with three experts from three different angles, a defense attorney, a journalist, and a judge. You can join the conversation. Let us know your questions and comments on the topic by finding us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also send us a voice message through our free smartphone app. It's called All in Vox Pop. Just search for All in Vox Pop on your phone's app store. Send us your question or comment, and we'll try to get it on the show. Now, Karen, I would say, got to have sort of an outsider perspective. You were not involved directly in these cases. You saw it from the outside. What was that like over the last 20 years? Did you see any changes from when you first started covering it until now?
Yeah, so we first started filming in 1999. And since that time, the changes in the system overall, and I'm not just talking Indiana, I'm talking nationwide, have really been massive. You've already touched on brain research. That was never a conversation back in 1999. At least I don't recall ever, you know, discussing the medical side of this. Other than we did, touch on the fact that so many times children who come into abuse and neglect court oftentimes later end up in delinquency court. And so we did see that correlation, and we did try and connect those dots between child welfare court and juvenile delinquency court. But really, we never talked about the medical side and how the brain develops. That's really a rather new phenomenon over the past 25 years. So we have seen that lead to, I think, changes in laws in various states. We've also seen a lot of states raise the age of adulthood. That was a big change over the past 20 years. You know, it used to be, I know you touched on earlier with Mary Beth and Don, what are the crimes that can be automatic waivers for kids from the juvenile justice system to the adult system? And what we've seen over the years is various states waive the age of adulthood. So it used to be, when we filmed in Mary Beth's court in Lake County, kids from Chicago, the age of adulthood in Illinois was 17, and in Indiana it was 18. So you would sometimes see kids from Chicago come over the state line, and for whatever reason, they would commit an offense in Indiana. And in Indiana, they were still a juvenile if they were 17. But if they were back in Illinois, 18 would, you know, or they were still a juvenile in Indiana, but they would have been an adult in Illinois. So we've seen age of adulthood laws change. We've also seen, I'm noticing, and I know, I think this is true in most Lake County jurisdictions right now, we've seen a drop in the population in the detention centers. Some people think that's good. Some people think that's bad. As journalists, we try and explore both sides. you know, prosecutors, I just talked to a prosecutor yesterday in Ohio who runs the juvenile division there. And, you know, she said, our focus is community safety. And so, you know, we have to keep an eye on that. At the same time, I talked to the defense attorney, and the defense attorney had the opposite view. You know, we need to put as many resources as possible to these kids early on so they don't go into the adult system. We have followed kids. Some kids we've followed for 20 years, and we've been able to see how certain services work or don't work. We've seen great outcomes. We've seen really sad outcomes. And I think at the end of the day, you know, human nature being what it is, and kids, you know, oftentimes going back to the very same situations and communities that got them in trouble in the first place, whether it be gangs or abusive situations, oftentimes you see them repeat. And so then, you know, the question becomes, what is the right answer for these kids? Personally, having followed really young kids in adult prison, that's a really difficult thing to see and watch, and to watch them grow up. Some, you know, we followed kids as young as 12 who have been sentenced to adult prison. That's a really, I don't believe kids that young belong in the adult system. I think they deserve the resources that the juvenile system can offer. Mary Beth would probably agree with me on that. She was very adamant back when we filmed with her about making sure that all the services of the juvenile system were afforded to these, especially these really young kids who may have committed a terrible crime. But 12 years old to send a 12-year-old to an adult prison, is to watch that in person, is it's traumatic.
And maybe I can just interject too. And I think the way I always look at this too, and why we are probably everybody on this interview today would not support the legislature telling the juvenile court what they have to do at what age. You know, if I think everybody listening would agree that if you have a 5-year-old who picks up a gun that was left by a parent on a table and shoots a sibling, that 5-year-old didn't commit murder and shouldn't go to adult jail, right? But what about a 10-year-old who does the same thing, who picks up the gun, shoots the sibling, and maybe not? Well, what about a 15-year-old? Right. So the maybe some would say no. I mean, the point is there clearly are is a scale that, rather than an arbitrary age where if someone's going to turn 17 tomorrow, yet they shoot somebody today, should they be treated differently merely because of what the calendar says? So I think my position, and probably most people I think would agree, is that we want the judge and those involved in hearing the case of juveniles to look at the big picture of what was going on, look at the circumstances, and then make the decision after accounting for all of those things, as opposed to just the legislature saying, look, because you are X number of years old on this date when you did this, you are going to adult jail.
Mm-hmm. Well, that makes me wonder, you know, how much power does state government have in creating these policies in areas that you're working in and that you see day to day?
Mary Beth, do you want to take that?
Well, they have enormous power. You know, I mean, one day you couldn't have a gun, you know, without a permit, and we're close to having being able to carry guns with no permits. You know, the legislature has just enormous authority and power. And hopefully, and I agree with Don and what Karen said, I mean, what we're going to do as a society, I think, is we're going to obviate the need for judges, because if we have rules that say at a certain age with a certain crime, a certain outcome is what's going to happen, then what do we need judges for? Or police at that point? We'll just have people pick people up off the street. I've never been a proponent of, you know, like, say, zero tolerance, because zero tolerance is zero intelligence, in my estimation. You know, in court, in schools across our country, we had, well, we don't believe you should have, you know, drugs in school. And if anybody had, you know, an ounce of marijuana or whatever it was, or they were absent 5 days, you're out. I mean, without finding out what's going on in that child's life, that we would have rules without looking at the facts and circumstances, as I said, you know, moments ago. And that is the hallmark of a court system, and especially a juvenile court system, where we do what's right for kids and we talk about care, treatment, and rehabilitation. That's what the juvenile system is about. And we can't have people really, especially the legislature, telling courts what they have to do if certain things exist, like a certain age and a certain crime, without looking at where that child came from, what the circumstances were surrounding that child's rearing. I think that's so important.
Mm-hmm. So you said zero tolerance is zero intelligence. We're going to leave it at that and take a quick break. We're talking juvenile justice in Indiana and beyond. If you have questions or comments for our guests today, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Sobe. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Before the break, we were talking about how state government holds a lot of power when it comes to the courts. With us today to talk about juvenile justice, we have Karen Graw, juvenile justice documentarian, media producer, and former Indiana juvenile justice reporter, Mary Beth Bonaventura, a senior judge in Lake County and former Indiana Superior Court juvenile justice, and Don Ruck, an Indiana juvenile justice attorney. Mary Beth, I just wanted to follow up a little bit more. What would the solution be for the state legislature that's trying to dictate sort of age limits for when children should turn into adults?
Well, you know, I'm not sure what because I haven't, you know, really followed it, but I'm not sure what they're taking into account, what evidence they're looking at to change the law or to, you know, add to a law that currently exists. I'm hoping that they do look at things like brain research, which is it has been emerging for a while, but it's just there's so much of it out there that it would probably be easy for them to have access to see at what ages, you know, kids should really be held accountable for certain acts. I'm hoping that they're taking information from judges who actually do hear these cases and do this work, probation officers, police. I mean, everybody that touches the life of a child. Public defenders certainly are people they should look to and talk with. So what little I know about the legislature, and probably know a little bit to be dangerous, is that there are people and groups out there that are going to make sure they hear it, even if they, you know, already have a lot of information. There will be people that will be out there to make sure that the legislature has all of the information they need to make an informed decision as to what the law should look like going forward.
Mm-hmm. Well, Don, as an attorney that works in this field, do you see enough being done to prevent, I guess, these offenses from happening in the first place?
I'm sorry, you cut out there during the tail end of the question.
Do you think there's enough being done to prevent offenses from happening in the first place? Like digging deeper, like are there programs, you know, we're hearing about reforms to law enforcement, de-escalation training, things like this. Is there anything that's being done for juveniles?
Yeah, I mean, historically, that's always been the case. I mean, and don't forget, when we talk about the juvenile court system, we're not just talking about kids who've committed crimes or delinquent acts, as they're called in the juvenile system. But an equally and maybe in some way more important role of the juvenile court system is the side where we're taking control of kids' lives to try and prevent them from being abused or neglected by the family situation that they're currently in. And I don't know the statistics, but I would venture to guess that is as large of a number of cases that come through the juvenile court system are not where the kids have done something wrong, but where the kids are in a situation where they may do something wrong if the juvenile court doesn't intervene. So kids who aren't going to school, kids who are maybe being physically abused or sexually abused or those types of cases where we're not looking at all to punish the child, we're looking to put the family back together. Has with it an enormous amount of resources through the Indiana Department of Child Services that Mary Beth can certainly speak of, given her prior role with that agency. But that agency then becomes intimately involved and effectively a party in a lot of these cases that we deal with in the juvenile court setting, where we're providing drug and alcohol rehabilitation. We're providing casework services to try and help parents get jobs again. And we're really trying to, and Mary Beth has already said this, put a family back together with the hopes that we can get everybody kind of down the right path again. So on one hand, at least on that end of it, the spectrum of the cases we deal with, I think there is an enormous amount of resources that are available. There can certainly always be more, and funding becomes an issue, and you deal with a lot of efforts by some to try and cut back on funding of DCS and trying to help families, which I know is always an ongoing issue. But certainly they are available in that context. Now, on the delinquent side, when these cases come in, it is more skewed toward, you know, how do we try and either, punish and or rehabilitate? But it doesn't feel to me in that setting that there's as much of a push behind really trying to, right the wrong, so to speak, so it doesn't happen again.
Mm-hmm. And if I could jump in too, Miriam, I believe I read in the current bill that's before the full Indiana Senate, one of the things they are looking at is making sure that kids who are charged with adult crimes are housed in juvenile facilities versus adult facilities as they await trial. And I know we have actually filmed those very things in Indiana and across the country. The way juveniles are treated when they are sentenced as adults is they still have to be sight and sound separated from the adult offender population until they turn 18. So, for instance, we have filmed in adult prisons where juveniles have been sent, but they are in a specific cell house with other juveniles. They are sight and sound separated from the adult offender population. What becomes a bit crazy that we found out during filming is the minute that child turns 18, they don't know when, but literally a guard will show up at their cell door and say, pack your things, you're being transferred to the adult population. They don't know if they're being transferred to the adult population at the prison they're currently in, if they're going to be transported several hours away to a new adult prison somewhere else in the state of Indiana. So I do think that there are steps that can be taken that are a little more humane when it comes to juveniles as they intersect with the adult system. And I would always encourage any legislator, and I worked at the Indiana State House in a previous life. I worked for Governor Evan Bayh. And so I've had a seat at the table of policymaking decisions. And I would always encourage any legislator who is working on a piece of legislation like this, go visit a juvenile facility, go sit in a juvenile court, go to a prison and see where adults are, children are housed. I think that you really need to at least immerse yourself a little bit in this world if you're going to be responsible for passing laws to truly understand what that looks like on the front lines. And I always give credit to people who work on the front lines in this field, whether you're a correctional officer or a judge or a defense attorney. These cases are really, really difficult and very emotional. And I often say that anyone in the system has to suffer a little bit of PTSD once they've done it for a while. I used to tell Judge Bonaventure all the time, I don't know how you sit and listen to some of these wrenching stories day after day after day, you know, for what, 30 some years, Mary Beth? Yeah. Especially when it comes to child welfare cases and you're hearing about horrific cases of abuse and neglect. So I firmly encourage anyone who is discussing this subject matter or passing laws regarding children and families to take the time to really look into what it is you're considering changing a law about.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of how you're able to deal with this stuff, Mary Beth, what is it like having to listen to these types of stories all day, every day, and then just go home at night and try not to think about them?
I wish there was something I could tell you that I could share that would be that magic bullet, so to speak, for others in similar situations. I can tell you that, you know, I did do that for 31 years and then kind of took a hiatus from it for the last eight. In the last couple of months, I've gotten back into judging. And I will tell you that although I didn't think I missed it, I know this is going to sound like I probably need a psychological evaluation pretty quick, but I thought I didn't miss it until I came back. And I thought, oh my gosh, I feel like this is probably what I was put here to do. But I think it takes a certain kind of person, and those people that are doing judging out there, not just in the juvenile court system, but in any court that deals with people and human misery, you have to be the kind of person that likes to be in an emergency room, because you have to make a decision right now. We don't have judges, for the most part, unless you're doing some big corporate case. You don't have the luxury of taking things under advisement. You have to make a decision about life and death, about good and bad, about safety or not, right then and there. So I think that's a certain personality, and that's probably my personality. And then you have to have, as a judge, in hearing those kinds of cases, a lot of support around you in your own personal life. And I happen to have a great husband who, supports me in everything I've ever done. My family couldn't be more supportive, and things like that. You need to have that around you so that you can remember where your feet are planted and why they should be planted there, and that the importance of what you do and not that you staying sane really means that you can help other people get there and stay there. But I just happen to love it, and God's just put me, you know, in the right job for me. Mm-hmm. Hopefully for the people that have come before me as well. Yeah.
And I will say I'm sorry, Miriam, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Having filmed in many different courtrooms around the country, but primarily in Indiana, where we first started, and the Indiana Supreme Court was the first state Supreme Court in the country to allow this type of camera access back in 1999. You know, I can say we've been very lucky to film with a lot of amazing judges. And so many times the trajectory of a child's life really can come down to that judge that they sit in front of. Juvenile courts do not have juries. So it's not as if Mary Beth can end a case and say, all right, it's up to the jury now. That's not how the juvenile court works. There are no juries. It's up to the judge. And obviously she and other judges take into account what the defense attorney, prosecutor, probation officers, and everyone else in the court bring to the table. But, you know, we have seen some cases of injustice, quite frankly. And so the quality of a juvenile judge does make a difference. And like I said, the vast majority of the judges we have filmed with have been wonderful. They have incredibly stressful jobs. But, you know, we have run into a few who use that position as a stepping stone. A lot of times that's the mantra. A lot of juvenile judges will tell you, what really bothers us, for those of us who want to be juvenile judges, is that some people will use this position as a stepping stone to become a criminal court judge, you know, a higher seated judge, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so judges like Judge Bonaventura and others that we've worked with who really dedicated their lives to kids in these cases just make an enormous difference in a child's life in what kind of services they are offered.
And Miriam, I think it's interesting too, because of kind of the work that Karen's been able to do along with the Indiana Supreme Court and Judge Bonaventura and allowing these series to be filmed. I think if you ask the average person, whether it's in Indiana or your listeners, what they know about the juvenile court, I think most would probably say, well, it's where kids who commit crimes go. But the reality is that, you know, as we discussed before, it is so much more than that. Not just dealing with how do we remedy bad homes and how do we keep kids safe. One of the areas that I currently focus in is dealing with the involuntary termination of parental rights. So, you know, people would probably be surprised to know that my guess is in Lake and Marion County, there's probably 1,000 kids a year where we go to trial in juvenile court. The goal is to, well, the what we're seeking is the involuntary termination of the parent-child relationship because of a history of whatever it is, violence, drug use, what have you. And if you can think of that in terms of the most serious sanctions that a state can impose upon a person, second only to punishing someone to death, would be what we do in juvenile court, and that's involuntarily taking their kids away forever and putting them in an adoptive placement. So the gravity and the significance of what happens in juvenile court is extraordinarily diverse and broad. And so the more that we can work to shed some light on what happens, I think in the long run is going to benefit families. And we'll also get the public to understand when these legislative issues come up, have a little better context and understanding as to what's going on. And it's interesting, Marion, you mentioned earlier how we have on the call today different perspectives, defense lawyer, judge, what have you. The irony, as you were mentioning that, was if you had probably a prosecutor, myself as a defense lawyer, and the judge on here, our perspectives probably wouldn't be nearly as different as if we were in adult court, where you would have a defense lawyer with a goal of finding somebody not guilty, a prosecutor with the goal of locking somebody up, and a judge who wants to just defer to the jury on these issues. Whereas during this conversation with these perspectives, there might be some differences, but there's a lot of overlap in what we're attempting to do. And that's ultimately, provide for the welfare of the kids that come through the system.
And I will say, too, in the work that we do at Calamari Productions and why we petitioned the Indiana Supreme Court in the first place for this extraordinary access is we also felt that not only do the frontline staff and judges and prosecutors and defense attorneys deserve a voice to say, here is the reality of what we do. We also felt that the kids and the families deserved a voice, too. And over the past 23 years, the outcomes we've seen with some of these kids and families and the outpouring of support from the public to help them once they saw their stories has really been, to me, the most rewarding aspect of this work. We have had kids who have been offered full college scholarships after our shows have aired. We have had, after one show that we filmed with Mary Beth and Don in Lake County, after one series, the former legal counsel for Stanford University reached out to us and said, there's a group of us out here in California that want to become mentors to some of the kids that were in that show. And so it really, I think, a camera can be both good and bad, right? We all know that. And some people are against cameras in the courtroom. But we think when you do it for documentary purposes and you do long form journalism and you're able to illuminate all these issues, it brings a level of humanity to the juvenile courts and juvenile facilities that you might not read when all you do is, or you might not understand if all you do is read a crime headline. I think that people, Don said it, I think a lot of people just have no idea what goes on inside these courtrooms. And we think it's an important learning experience. And we use everything we film for education and training purposes. It's not just for TV.
Well, thank you all so much for joining us today. It sounds like we're learning that the juvenile justice system, you're all working together for the greater good of the children when there's a lot of other misconceptions out there. I want to thank all of our guests for taking the time today. Karen Graw, juvenile justice documentarian, Mary Beth Bonaventura, senior judge in Lake County and former Indiana Superior Court juvenile justice, and Don Ruck, Indiana juvenile justice attorney. Our producers are Drew Dodlin, Micah Yason, and Tim Brook. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. Join us tomorrow for a look at vaccine hesitancy. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Soeb. Thanks for listening. This is All In.